I got a bare belly. Ain't nothing gonna do about it. I got a bare belly. Ain't gonna change.
I'm Shelley Schlender. You're tuned to KGNU. It's 8:36, and we have a special show for you this morning where you get to call in and talk with Dr. Bill Davis. He's the author of the national bestseller Wheat Belly, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. He's also the author of a Wheat Belly cookbook with 150 recipes to help you find your way to health. Last but not least, Bill will be speaking at the University of Denver's Newman Center for Performing Arts at 7:30 on August 19th. That's coming up, and by calling and talking with Bill Davis, you can actually get some tickets here or some books if you call and pledge your support or renew your membership as we're doing these talks. And you can also call Bill to ask him information yourself about Wheat Belly and your experiences with different ways to eat and your health. Welcome to KGNU, Dr. Davis.
Good morning, Shelley.
Tell me this. Did you used to have a beer belly?
Well, I had a belly all right, but it wasn't from drinking beer. It was, I fell into this trap about 25 years ago of going vegetarian. I limited all meat and added oils, and I followed a diet that was rich in lots and lots of healthy whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. While I was jogging 3 to 5 miles a day, and I gained about 30 pounds, I had awful blood numbers like triglyceride level of 350 and a fasting blood sugar of 161, which is well into the diabetic range. So I'm jogging every day, enjoying it, thinking I'm as healthy as can be, not quite understanding why I grew a belly and gained weight, but became diabetic.
All of those things are not supposed to happen because you were eating exactly the kind of diet that is recommended by most of the major health groups in the United States. You go to some place like Whole Foods, a great natural food store, and this is the diet they recommend too. What were you doing wrong?
Well, what everyone is doing wrong, including nutritionists, dietitians, our own USDA, etc., is they fell for this flawed logic that if you replace something bad, white flour products, with something less bad, whole grains, and there's an apparent health benefit. And there is, Shelley. There's no question that if you do that, you're better off. And then the logic they use says you must eat a whole bunch of the less bad thing. What they didn't ask is what happens when you remove it? And we have to look elsewhere for those answers, but that's what I do, and that's when I see astounding changes, not small changes. I'm not talking about feeling a little bit better or losing 3 or 4 pounds. We're talking about astounding changes in health and weight and appetite and many other aspects of health.
Well, Bill, but Davis, you're a cardiologist, you're a doctor, but what if this way to eat just happens to fit you? I mean, has anybody else ever benefited from eating this way that you're describing?
I've lost count. We're probably into the millions now. So this movement has gained astounding steam, Shelley. So if you just go on social media, and by the way, I think it is social media that drives this. I don't believe it's my good looks or charm that drives this movement. I think it's the social movement driven by social media, because if you go on my Facebook page, Friends for Wheat Belly, you'll see this flying by. I lost 73 pounds in 6 months. I'm down 113 pounds in a year. I'm no longer diabetic. I lost 8 inches off my waist. I gave up 3 inhalers for my asthma. I had daily migraines for 25 years. They were gone within 3 days. My rheumatoid arthritis is so much better. I'm off all 3 drugs. My seborrhea along the sides of my face went away. My psoriasis went away. My depression lifted for the first time in 20 years. The food obsessions I had, and it was called bulimia or binge eating disorder, went away within 5 days. I'm down 30 pounds in 2 months. In other words, it's this mass movement we've created. So it's not just me. I just happened to experience. And by the way, when I first did it, I didn't think it was the wheat. I thought it was my gluttony, laziness, or ignorance. And so I didn't really put two and two together. It took me many years to figure this all out.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Davis, the author of Wheat Belly, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. He has a recipe book. He has this book. He also is going to be speaking in Denver on August 19th at 7:30. And all of these are things that you can participate in, too. You can call us here at 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242 to talk with Dr. Bill Davis. If you'd like to get one of these wonderful offerings as a premium, You can also pledge your support to KGNU, and we have these offered at the $60 level for Wheat Belly and the Wheat Belly Cookbook, and for them both, or one of those books plus tickets to the lecture on the 19th, we have those at $88.50. So call us here at 303-442-4242 to share your questions and comments with Dr. Davis and possibly to get some of these premiums. I've got a question for you now, Dr. Davis. Wheat is the staff of life. If you have not heard that, then I think it's time for you to. That this has been a staple in the world diet, for at least in the Western diet, for 2,000 years, and you're saying people shouldn't eat it.
That's right. Actually, it's been a staple for something like 10,000 years, which sounds like a long time, unless you put this into the perspective of how long humans have been around. So 2.4 million years, humans have tried to adapt to life on Earth by eating the flesh and organs of animals and the edible parts of plants and mushrooms and nuts and berries and all those sorts of things that people instinctively regard as food. In a time of desperation, 10,000 years ago, we saw what the wild goats and cows, the ibex and aurochs, were eating. This thing called einkorn wheat, wild wheat, a 14-chromosome plant that grew wild in the Middle East. And we asked, can we eat that like those ruminant creatures? And we tried and we got sick. We had to figure out how to eat this grass. That's what wheat is. It's a grass. We figured out that the only edible part of this grass, einkorn wheat, was the seed. We had to isolate the seed, throw away the roots, shaft, leaves, and the husk, and if we pulverized it and heated it, so it required fire, it required pottery, we learned that we could eat this thing and live another day, week, or month. What we didn't recognize is that we paid a long-term health price. And so, yes, we have consumed it for 10,000 years. Now, if we were still eating the traditional forms of old wheat, not changed by agribusiness nor geneticists, we probably wouldn't have a lot of the problems we have. So traditional wheat is less harmful than modern wheat. The real trouble started about 40, 50 years ago when agribusiness and geneticists got into the act.
Well, let's break this into two parts, because you've said two different things. You've said that wheat, although it nourished us, also caused some problems, even ancient wheat. And you've said that modern wheat is even more damaging than ancient wheat. Can you start with what you think might be wrong even with ancient wheat?
Well, you know what's interesting, Shelley? The anthropologists have known this for decades. They asked, what happened when agriculture first took root in the Middle East and in other parts of the world with corn and other forms of grains? But let's focus on wheat in the Middle East. That's where this got started. What happened to those humans? We experienced explosive tooth decay. Very interestingly, prior to the consumption of grains, tooth decay was almost unknown, despite the lack of dental floss, toothpaste, toothbrushes, dentists, orthodontists, fluoridated water, etc. Almost no tooth decay. Until grains entered the picture, we went from 0.4% of all teeth recovered with decay to 16 to 49% of all teeth recovered showing decay, as well as tooth loss, abscess, malformations of the teeth, tooth crowding. We also experienced iron deficiency, which shows up in the skull. That's how anthropologists detect it. We experienced a reduction in height and bone diameter. In other words, when humans consumed grains, we paid a very significant health price. But you know what? It did provide a cheap form of calories, a cheap, accessible form of calories.
And so it was better than not eating anything. It gave us a chance to grow cities, because once you could grow crops, you could grow places for people to live that were more concentrated. So there was a trade-off of health benefits versus not health benefits that kind of equaled out. But you have a major concern now with modern wheat. And here's the thing, Dr. Davis, we're not talking about GMOs. Wheat is not genetically modified. So how can it be bad as modern wheat?
That's absolutely right. So we've paid a price for the sake of growing a population. I agree with that completely. So about 40, 50 years ago, a geneticist got into the act in the hopes of increasing yield per acre. So this was not part of an evil plot. It was simply meant to be an effort to increase yield per acre to help feed hungry people. And you're right. The techniques used to change wheat predate the modern methods of genetic modification. So there were no gene splicing techniques used to insert or delete a gene. The methods used were such things as repetitive hybridization, over and over to try to select out specific characteristics, and chemical gamma ray, X-ray, and ultraviolet mutagenesis. The purposeful induction of mutations.
Mayor, can you close my door?
The purposeful induction of mutations. The problem with that is you cannot control all the mutations you get. So herbicide-resistant wheat now on the market, very popular, by the way, is not the product of genetic modification, but of chemical mutagenesis. That is filled with mutations that cannot be controlled. It looks like wheat, it performs like wheat in a baking experience, but it is the product of mutagenesis. Now, we're told that modern wheat's not the product of genetic modification. What you're not told is the methods that predate genetic modification in many instances are worse than genetic modification.
Can you close my door?
Well, as we're thinking about that, I think that the issue that I see is that this is how we grow every plant. We grow every plant through these kind of standard ways to do genetic modification to grow better plants. And couldn't it be that these people who grew this new modern wheat were growing something better than old-fashioned wheat?
It depends on your perspective, doesn't it? If your perspective is that of increased yield or resistance to drought or herbicide resistance, then it is better. But if your perspective is being exposed to unique allergens or proteins that have never been consumed before by humans, then we might have a problem. For instance, note all the allergies in kids. When you and I were in school, we didn't have people who couldn't eat peanuts and corn and soy and so on, because agribusiness has been changing the foods and changing, in particular, the protein. So to a great degree, Shelley, the worst offenses in food are grains that have high protein content. So if you genetically modify an apple, there's less than 1% protein in an apple, so it doesn't have that many implications. But grains tend to have a higher protein content. Wheat in particular can have a quite substantial protein content, which is often regarded as good, until you realize that these are unique proteins never before seen by humans.
Now, as part of your suggestion that wheat might be a problem, you've mentioned a couple of times opiate-like qualities or cravings, and you've mentioned that when people get off of wheat, you have observed that they start to make better choices in everything else that they eat. What is this about wheat and opium? They're not in the same plant family.
That's right. So this research comes from the National Institutes of Health in the late 1970s. They were interested, Shelley, in finding out why and trying to understand why several psychiatric groups here in the UK had made this observation. If you take closed ward populations of people with schizophrenia and you take all wheat out of the diet, they improve. They're not cured. They're just improved. They have less paranoia. They experience less hearing voices, auditory hallucinations, and they can socially engage once again. If you add wheat back over 4 weeks, they get worse. Pardon me.
And so,
if you take wheat out, they get better again.
And so there is some data that says that. It's not very strong data. There have not been more studies indicating that. On that data, it's not clear whether it's just the wheat or if it's taking out that form of carbohydrate or if it's all grains, because rye and wheat tend to have similar components. But there are some studies that hint that this product, something like wheat, can have some effects on mental health.
Absolutely. So I'll finish what I started to talk about, and that is that this NIH group, National Institutes of Health group, narrowed it down to the gliadin protein of wheat that is degraded in the human gastrointestinal tract. They're very small particles, small polypeptides that bind to the opiate receptors of the human brain. So they act like opiates, but they don't act like morphine or heroin. They don't give us a high nor pain relief. They only stimulate appetite. And that's in everyday people. Now, people with unique susceptibilities will experience other effects. So people with schizophrenia become paranoid. People with bipolar illness will experience the mania of their condition. Kids with ADHD or autistic spectrum disorder will have behavioral outbursts or impaired learning capacity. People who are prone to depression experience depression. People who are prone to binge eating disorder or bulimia will experience intrusive food obsessions. So this gliadin collection of opiates that comes from wheat has unique effects in different people. And the mind effects extend even farther. Wheat consumption, this is well established in the medical literature, can be a cause for epilepsy, for seizures. It's now been found to cause dementia. This is Mayo Clinic data. In other words, we're talking about something we're told to eat more and more of that we know causes mind and brain impairment.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Davis. He's the author of Wheat Belly, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Way Back to Health, which has been a national New York Times bestseller for weeks and weeks and weeks. And he'll be coming to Denver in August, on August 19th, to talk in Denver about this topic. You can call us here to share your questions or thoughts with Dr. Davis at 303-442-4242. Now, Dr. Davis, I'm going to push you a little bit harder on some of these things.
Sure.
Because on many of these topics that you're talking about, there are many theories about how you can, through something like nutrition, change somebody's health. And wheat is one of them that's getting a lot of attention right now. So is lowering your carbohydrates altogether is the classic treatment, for instance, for epilepsy at Johns Hopkins University. Not just wheat, all carbohydrates. And so there are a lot of different therapies out there that work in different ways and people advocate. And we all know people who eat a lot of bread and a lot of pasta, and they don't have bipolar, they don't have weight problems, they do fine. So how do you explain them?
All right. Well, lots of territory to cover there, Shelley. But the exceptions do not disprove the rule, right? And by the way, those people who think they're getting away with consuming wheat are not. In other words, just because you're not fat and diabetic does not mean you're not having adverse effects from wheat, because I see this every single day of my life, that is, I do metabolic assessments in patients, and people who think they're healthy, they feel fine, they don't perceive anything wrong with consuming wheat until they see their blood work. They see high hemoglobin A1Cs. That's an after-eating blood sugar effect, because wheat raises blood sugar higher than even table sugar. They see high triglycerides, small LDL particles. Shelley, the number one cause for heart disease in the U.S. today is an excess of small LDL particles caused by the amylopectin A unique to wheat. They have increased bowel permeability, intestinal permeability. That's the first step in generating the 75 autoimmune inflammatory conditions that humans get. This is well-sorted-out data from University of Maryland. In other words, you may not be aware of it. You might think that the cataracts you got diagnosed with at age 60 are just part of getting old. That's a wheat phenomenon. You may think that the arthritis you now feel in your knee is just from age and overuse. That is, to a large degree, a wheat-related phenomenon. So people don't often blame the health problems they have on this thing they're consuming, but more often than not, the chronic health conditions that plague modern Americans are from consuming healthy whole grains, but specifically, most of all, modern high-yield semi-dwarf wheat.
Well, Dr. Davis, it sounds like something where you would certainly suggest that if somebody has some health problems, either in their blood work or in their mood or in their overall health, achy joints and so forth, that wheat might be one of the things to eliminate for a while just to check it out. And could there be blood tests also that a person could take to check and see if they have this thing that you call, is it a gliadin sensitivity?
You can. The problem comes in that most, the vast majority, Shelley, the vast majority of intolerances to wheat do not have a specific blood test. Like, and that's why people say, why should I stop wheat? I don't have celiac disease. That's the autoimmune disease that's triggered only in 1% of the population who consume wheat. There's another several percent of people who have what you're talking about, the gliadin sensitivity, and have positive anti-gliadin antibodies. But the rest of the people, the 92-93% of other Americans who can't be identified by either of those kinds of tests, still have problems with other components of wheat. It could be that abnormal intestinal permeability from that gliadin protein.
Oh, you mean that
those, the mind.
You mean that those tests that are documented as being tests you can use to check for a problem with grains don't catch all the problems with grains?
That's right, not even close. You can still be quite diabetic with a negative test for celiac disease or a gliadin antibody test. You can still have seizures, the temporal lobe seizures from wheat, and have negative tests. You can still have acid reflux, asthma, chronic sinus congestion, weight gain, visceral fat, small LDL particles, coronary disease, and heart attack. You can still have all manner of wheat-related illnesses with negative gliadin antibody and celiac tests.
Well, okay, so suppose let's say that somebody wants to try to see if weed is one of their problems. And by the way, if you're listening, if you want to call us here at 303-442-4242, you can ask specific questions of Dr. Davis, and he'll give you some thoughts about that. It won't be medical advice, but it'll be ideas. That's 303-442-4242. Now, I've got a question for you, Dr. Davis, and that is that if I decide I have achy joints or a runny nose or too many headaches, and I cut out wheat, what does it take? A couple of days and then I'll know?
It depends on the condition, Shelley. So if it's acid reflux or sinus congestion, so gastrointestinal, common gastrointestinal complaints, joint pains, particularly in the fingers and wrists, and mind effects, tend to recede starting at about 3 to 5 days. More complex disorders, inflammatory conditions, autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, polymyalgia rheumatica, etc., those take longer. They can take up to weeks or months. Neurological impairment takes the longest of all because nervous system tissue doesn't heal very well. They take months or even a year or two. But for the most part, the most common conditions like joint pain, gastrointestinal problems, and upper respiratory problems recede within 3 to 5 days. So most people, by doing this, will know just within a few days, though that experience can be clouded by what you talked about, and that is the common withdrawal effect. So about 40% of people will experience wheat withdrawal, which is nausea, fatigue, depression, and headache. And it can be very unpleasant, by the way. It's not an easy process for a lot of people.
Do you mean that as somebody is trying to get better, they can start out by feeling worse?
Yes, absolutely. And it can be quite unpleasant. I don't know of a way not to have the withdrawal if you're going to have it, except to hydrate, try to do it at a time when you're not overly stressed, like work pressures and so on. A lot of people take a probiotic in the early few weeks because there's a transition of bowel flora, and people can at first be bloated and have constipation or even diarrhea. So there are some measures you can take to blunt the effects of the withdrawal, but the withdrawal can be quite unpleasant. It lasts about 5 days for the majority of people.
Does it work just to get rid of wheat? Is that all that you need to do? Like if I decided I love bread, so I'm going to switch to what is it called? Gluten-free bread. How about that? And then they're going to be okay?
I'm glad you asked. Because what we don't want to do, Shelley, if we want ideal health, we don't want to replace a problem, wheat, with another problem, what I call gluten-free junk carbohydrates. So the gluten-free industry has made a very, very, very bad mistake. They've chosen four ingredients, cornstarch, rice flour, tapioca starch, or potato starch, as the replacement flours for wheat and gluten. Problem, those dried pulverized starches are among the very few foods that raise blood sugar even higher than wheat. So it's very typical that people say, I went gluten-free, and I don't get it. I didn't lose any weight. Like, I gained 18 pounds. That's from the gluten-free junk carbohydrates. So if you want bread or pizza or cookies or muffins, what I do is I show you how to make it with benign and healthy ingredients.
Well, I guess that probably in your books you talk some about that, and we'll find out some more about what kind of foods people eat instead of their favorite breads and pastas. But first, let's take a call from Drew. Drew, welcome to KGNU.
Hi. I'm sorry I tuned in a little bit late, but I did hear you mention modern wheat and high-yield modern wheat. And I'd like, if you might be a repetition, but is it that the wheat that humans consumed for millennia before the modern era was probably better or okay compared to what we have today in this agribusiness wheat?
A very common concern, Drew. So I would argue that the older forms of wheat, whether we go back to the forms of 1950 that predate the genetic changes, or if we go back to traditional forms of 19th century, like Red Fife, which is very popular in U.S. and Canada, or go back even farther, how about to the emmer wheat of the Bible, or the einkorn wheat that predates the Bible. Every step back we go, wheat becomes more and more benign, less harmful. Do we ever get to a place where wheat is completely benign and actually healthy? I don't believe we do. It is less harmful the farther we go, but it's not entirely benign because we know that humans who ate even ancient forms of wheat got very ill. That's why I believe we would see such things as explosive tooth decay in the Egyptians. We found tooth decay and other health impacts when primitive humans first incorporated wheat. In other words, every time we see a culture adopt wheat, we saw a downturn in health, even in the traditional forms.
So it was never an ideal grain, but it did give people enough fuel to go out and work and function, but not never an ideal grain.
Exactly right. So if we're willing to accept the compromise, we just have to be aware it is a compromise. So, yes, we survive, and that's exactly what has happened on a worldwide scale. We've allowed the Earth to populate it with 7 billion people by feeding them cheap, easy calories created by agribusiness, such that 20% of all human calories now come from wheat, 50% of all human calories worldwide come from wheat, corn, and rice.
Well, Drew, I'm curious, are you somebody who likes to eat wheat, corn, and rice?
Well, yeah, I do, and I don't apparently have any negative effects, but I'm curious to see what happens if I don't eat it, and I'm curious what grains are okay.
That's a good question. Let me go ahead and say we're at KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM, and it's 9 o'clock. I'm Shelley Schlender, and our guest is Dr. Bill Davis of Wheat Belly. Lose the weight, and find your path back to health. And Drew, you've just asked, what grains can people have if they're not going to eat things like wheat, and what are some others that they shouldn't really eat if they've got health problems, Dr. Davis?
Well, I pick on wheat. I pick on wheat, Shelley, because it's the worst of the worst, particularly modern high-yield semi-dwarf wheat. No other grain, whether it's millet or rye or rice or corn, no other grain, for instance, can cause abnormal bowel permeability that leads to autoimmune diseases. No other grain degrades the opiates that have mind effects in children or cause behavioral outbursts or mind fog or appetite stimulation. So no other grain has some of the most awful effects that wheat has. It doesn't necessarily mean that other grains are entirely benign. So a bowl of stone-ground organic oatmeal, for instance, with no added sugar, will give you a sky-high blood sugar. They tell you it's heart healthy. No, it's not. It actually causes extravagant rises in blood sugar. So all the grains share a very marked potential to raise blood sugar very high.
Well, Drew, thank you for your comments. We have another caller on the line we're going to go to. Jean, welcome to KGNU. Is this you or is this, oh, excuse me, is this Nancy? Who do we have on the line right now? I tell you what, whoever is there, can you turn down your radio? That's one thing for you to do.
Yes, I don't know. Do you have me or Nancy?
Oh, and I have you. Who are you?
Eugene.
Hi, Eugene. Thank you for being on KGNU. What's your comment?
Thank you. Well, was a question about the other grains, exactly rice and oats instead. I'm thinking about the whole continent of Asia that eats rice instead of wheat. Maybe not the whole continent, but the east part of it, Chinese, Japanese, etc. How about that? And oats, please expand on that, please.
So we're talking still about this whole notion of what grains are okay.
I would characterize
other grains, Eugene, as being less harmful than wheat. If we go back to what the anthropologists tell us, you'll see that when primitive humans first consumed wheat, we had all sorts of health problems. When primitive humans first consumed corn in the Americas about 8,000 years ago, we had all kinds of health problems, very similarly. When humans first consumed sorghum and millet in sub-Saharan Africa 8,000 years ago, we had all kinds of health problems. The only exception to this is rice. When primitive Asians in southwest and southern Asia first consumed rice from the swamps of Asia, they're the only population that did not suffer all the health consequences that come from grain. So I would argue that rice is probably the most benign of all grains. Now, rice is also the recipient, though, of genetic modification. So we have, you know, that's part of the modern conversation now, isn't it? That we can no longer just talk about what a traditional food is like, because agribusiness and geneticists have gotten into the act and have been changing things. Now, maybe some of those changes are benign, but we often don't know that for a fact, because as you know, they often don't test these things in animals nor in humans. Now, we do have some data coming out, in particular about corn, that genetic modification is leading to all sorts of unforeseen consequences. So I would argue that grains of all forms are potentially dangerous, though they're nowhere near as bad as modern semi-dwarf wheat.
Eugene, thank you for your comment. We're going to go next to Nancy. So, Nancy, welcome to KGNU. Are you there? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry. I also had a question about rice usage in Asia, but it was an evidentiary question. In other words, if these problems with wheat are true as compared to rice, which is, as the guest was saying, is much more benign, then I would think that a lot of the conditions that are supposedly caused by wheat would not exist in countries that are primarily rice-based in terms of their diet. So I'd like to know if there are studies about that.
Well, we know that the world is shifting towards wheat consumption. So this is probably largely driven by commerce and our own USDA and the attitudes of Americans and American government. So the situation's kind of messy nowadays, Nancy, so it's hard to really separate the effects in a large culture on an epidemiologic basis. But I would still stick to this argument that rice is probably the most benign. Not to say it's entirely benign, but rice doesn't have, for instance, the gliadin effects of wheat, stimulating appetite and increasing intestinal permeability.
But in terms of proof, you can't buttress your argument about wheat by referring to studies that show that, in fact, in countries where wheat is eaten much less than rice, that there are differential effects. Because I'm sure that still in China and Japan, for example, rice is the predominant food. I know it wouldn't be totally clean, but what you're saying is there aren't any studies that can support the argument that you're making by contrasting this country with some other country.
When you start looking at entire countries and trying to extract observations, it becomes very hazardous because it's very tough to characterize the eating habits of an entire nation because they're so varied and disparate. And there's more to diet, of course, than just rice or wheat. So it's very difficult to take lessons on a population basis.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Nancy, for your comments. Next, we'll go to Fatou. Fatou, welcome to KGNU.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first one is, what is the address and the time when he's coming to Denver?
Well, thank you for calling. I have here that, Dr. Davis, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I see that you'll be in Denver talking on August 19th at 7:30 at Denver's Newman Center for Performing Arts about the experience of weightlessness.
All right. Thank you. The second question
is,
I'm doing the organic farming. And I just found out, I was trying to get the organic grain. I just found out the person has already sowed a hybrid seed in the ground, on the farm. How can we actually grow an organic grain on the same farm safely?
Oh, you're talking about organic wheat. Are you a farmer or are you a gardener?
I'm a farmer.
Okay. Oh, interesting. And so you're trying to figure out whether or not you can grow organic wheat after you've been on a plot where it hasn't been organic.
Right. Well, a hybrid seed has been already found in it, and the person did not know. Now we want to know if we can do organic farming on the same land.
I think we're getting beyond the scope of what we're discussing today. But let me address this notion of, is organic wheat okay? Because that's a very common question I'm asked. And I would argue, well, it's better, right? It has no synthetic herbicides or pesticides, but it's the same stuff. The seed is the same. It still expresses the same gliadin protein. It expresses the same wheat germagglutinin. We haven't talked about that. It's a direct bowel toxin. Still has mind effects. Still causes rheumatoid arthritis. In other words, it's still the same high-yield semi-dwarf strain of wheat that was created in a laboratory. So it may be organic and raised with manure and et cetera, but it's still the same seed. Still has all the same effects.
But if somebody's going to grow wheat, would you recommend that they grow the older varieties? Would that be your preference, Dr. Davis?
Well, I would say I'd rather have you grow green peppers. But if you must, that would be a reasonable trade-off, that is, to go to the traditional forms. And by the way, Shelley, that is exactly what's happening. I know this is happening on a fair scale in Saskatchewan and a lot of the wheat-growing areas in Canada, to some degree in the U.S. So, you know, farmers are nice people. For the most part, they say, you know what, I hear what you say, and I don't want to contribute to killing people and hurting them. What can I do? Can I grow red fife? That is the form of wheat grown in the 19th century. You know, if we did make a massive shift back, we would be better off. But I would say, you know, most of the people I know, Shelley, want ideal health. And if you want ideal health, not just somewhat better health, I would say if you go wheat-free, that's when you see the real magic. That's where you see complete turnarounds in a long, long list, about 200 health conditions.
Well, Fatou, thank you for your comments, and good luck with your farming. And before we go to the next caller, we have a question from Jenny, who asks, wheat, does it depend on how much you eat, or is it just a small amount that can set off a reaction? What's your answer to that, Dr. Davis?
It takes very little to do bad things. For instance, that autoimmune effect only takes a little bit eaten on occasion. Small LDL particles, the number one cause for heart disease in the U.S., I would argue, is a particle triggered for about a week at a time. In other words, if you have just a wheat containing product once a week, you have risk for heart disease 7 days a week. So many of the effects of wheat are very durable.
And then how about somebody with celiac disease? If they only have a fair amount of wheat once every 6 weeks, is that okay, or will that continue to set off their autoimmune reaction?
A good question, because celiac disease represents the extreme of wheat intolerance. And if that person has a little bit of an indulgence, one, they have all kinds of gastrointestinal problems, usually, and other effects like joint pains, but they are exposed to as much as a 70-fold, Shelley, increased risk for intestinal lymphoma. That is a form of cancer that is very difficult to treat. So people with celiac disease must not ever have an indulgence. They must be absolutely meticulous to never have any wheat, any form, because they escalate their risk for cancer dramatically.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Davis. He will be in town on August 19th at 7:30 at the Denver's Newman Center for Performing Arts, talking about these fascinating topics. You can call us here with a question for Dr. Davis at 303-442-4242. And right now, I believe that we are going to go to Kim. Kim, welcome to KGNU.
Hi, thank you.
What's your comment for Dr. Davis?
My question is, in your discussion about grains that are better choices than wheat, I haven't heard you talk about quinoa. Can you address quinoa?
A quinoa is really a little bit different. The only problem I know about in quinoa, Kim, is blood sugar effects. I know quinoa is getting a reputation as being a benign seed, but I would argue it's not. You know, there's a very simple thing people can do. Sometimes people say, that seems a little fishy to me. A very simple thing you can do to prove to yourself. You can go to a big box store like Walmart or Walgreens and buy yourself a glucose meter. You can buy these things now for about $10. Sometimes your doctor will even give you one and allows you to check your blood sugar after you eat or when you're fasting. And there's a very simple experiment you can run. Check a blood sugar, a little finger stick, a blood sugar just prior to, before eating a food, and then check it again about an hour. An hour is about where the blood sugar peak occurs. A lot of my colleagues tell people, check it after 2 hours, because that's where blood sugar returns to normal. That's not the question here. The question is, what is the glycemic effect of different foods? And this more than many other things, will make you really smart and effective about diet. And if you check your blood sugar an hour after eating oatmeal, for instance, it goes sky high. Typical in a non-diabetic average person would be 180 to 200.
Right,
two slices
right.
of whole wheat bread, about 173. After a cup of cooked quinoa, no added sugar, about 180. Very typical. In other words, the high blood sugars like that are very destructive. They do things to proteins in the body that are irreversible. That's a process called glycation. That's the process that leads to skin aging, cataracts, arthritis, brittle cartilage, kidney damage, etc. It's part of the process of aging, but you accelerate it by the process of glycation experience every time you have a high blood sugar. So quinoa is not as bad as wheat, but it doesn't mean it's entirely benign.
Well, Kim, thank you for your comment. I think that we're going to go to the next caller, and that caller is, I believe we are talking with Ashley. Ashley, welcome to KGNU. Hello? Excuse me, it's Steve. Okay, Steve, welcome to KGNU.
All right, thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks for the program. I had a question for the doctor. What about the nut flours out there, the almond flours of the world, and who knows what other ones are out there. And what's his take on those?
Well, good question, Steve. So what I do a lot of my day nowadays, oddly, is because, you know, at first, Shelley, I used to tell people, eat real single-ingredient foods, no wheat, try to minimize exposure to other grains, and you'll be fine. Don't add sugars. But you know what? So many people came back and said, you know, that's all well and fine, but you know what? I've got kids. I've got grandkids. I've got holidays. I've got entertaining. And people really wanted to feed their kids some pizza on occasion. They really wanted to have some cheesecake or a birthday cake or maybe some gravy not made with wheat flour with the holidays on their turkey. And so what I do is I show people how to recreate these things, but we're going to choose our ingredients carefully. We choose ingredients that don't contain wheat, don't contain other grains, no added sugars or minimal sugars, and we can recreate pizza crust or cheesecake or coffee cake, whatever, using nut meals or nut flours, coconut flour, and some other ingredients. I post a lot of these recipes, by the way, on my blog. They're in the books, et cetera. And you can make very delicious replacements. And if you do that thing with your blood sugar, for instance, you'll see that there is no rise in blood sugar when you do these things.
Well, thank you again for your comment, Steve, and your question. I'm going to go to the next caller, who will be Ashley in just a moment. But first, as we're getting Ashley on the line, Dr. Davis, what do you have for breakfast?
I had bacon and eggs and avocado this morning. My wife made it for me while I was writing. So it's a return, Shelley, to real, as often as possible, real single-ingredient foods. Foods least changed by agribusiness, preferably locally sourced, although there's lots of good things happening in food. People are talking about that. That's one of the greatest rewards of this, Shelley, is people are talking about their food. We've raised eyebrows, raised awareness of what's happening to food. We're seeing what's happening in genetic modification, the methods that predate genetic modification. But it's really trying to raise awareness, and we return to real single-ingredient foods.
And you can find out more by hearing Dr. Davis on August 19th at 7:30 at the Denver Newman Center for the Performing Arts. Now, before we go to you, Ashley, I've got one more question for you, Dr. Davis. You're a cardiologist, and you just said you have bacon for breakfast. Well, I'm assuming that you watch your blood sugar, your blood lipid numbers, your cholesterol numbers. How is your heart doing?
I don't watch my cholesterol numbers because I don't believe cholesterol has anything to do with heart disease. And by the way, those analyses have been coming out over the last 2 to 3 years, such as Dr. Ron Krause from UC Berkeley published an extensive reappraisal asking, does intake of fat, saturated fat, total fat, and cholesterol have anything to do with heart disease? No, it does not. That's a fiction. So we go to the next level of testing, which is not lipid or cholesterol testing, but lipoprotein testing. And you'll quickly see that a diet rich in healthy whole grains causes extravagant expression of the small LDL particles. You'll quickly learn that a diet high in fat, preferably good fats, not hydrogenated fats, a diet high in fat and very minimal exposure to grains and sugars, you completely eliminate many people or most people's small LDL particles. You have a dramatic rise in HDL, a drop in triglycerides, along with all those reductions in measures of blood sugar. So you'll find that if you don't resort to this silly concept of cholesterol testing and you go to the next level of superior testing, you find that what we've been told causes heart disease and diabetes. It's no surprise, once you see this, that we have the world's worst epidemic of diabetes the world has ever seen.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Davis, the author of Weak Belly, Lose the Wheat, and Find Your Way Back to Health. He'll be talking on August 19th in Denver. Ashley, what is your comment for Dr. Davis?
Hi, thank you. Your breakfast sounded delicious. It's nearly what I had this morning also.
Oh, great.
My question is, how do you feel about sprouting, like, ancient grains, and how does that affect your blood sugar?
Oh, good question. So I know of no manipulation, Ashley, whether it's sprouting or sourdough fermentation or organic. I know of no manipulation that completely eliminates all the adverse effects of modern wheat. So if you sprout it, you might have a modest reduction in expression of amylopectin A. That's the highly digestible carbohydrate. You might have a slight decrease in the gliadin protein. But for the most part, over 90% of all the components remain intact, and so it still has all the same problems of wheat.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, Ashley. And before we go to the next caller, Dr. Davis, in your books, do you explain a lot of the how-tos of how to do this kind of eating?
Yes, it's really pretty easy. It's don't eat wheat, obviously. Now, that's two-pronged, because there are obvious sources of shelley-leaf wheat, like bread, pasta, and pancake mix, but then there are so not-so-obvious sources. How about licorice and Campbell's tomato soup and instant soup mixes and taco seasoning and all frozen food, frozen dinners, all breakfast cereals? In other words, there's many hidden sources of wheat, too.
Okay, so
I'll tell you,
even at a restaurant where you say, I want something with just a little of that delicious sauce, could the sauce be thickened with wheat?
Very typically, exactly. Roux, gravies, et cetera. Now, thankfully, you know, all this fuss we've raised has triggered many restaurants to say, we offer, now they say gluten-free, but at least they're aware and they're trying to respond. I took my staff to lunch yesterday, and the chef came out when he heard that we wanted to be wheat-free, and he told us about all the different choices and the changes he could make. And so we had a wheat-free au jus on our meat. So more and more restaurants are starting to respond to this, and it's becoming easier and easier to not have those inadvertent exposures. I should mention, Shelley, that those of us who are wheat-free who have an exposure, whether it's intentional or inadvertent, many of us get sick. We get gastrointestinal distress, diarrhea and cramps and bloating. We get joint pain. We get headaches. We get emotional effects. Women get anxiety.
So there can be a lot of different changes and challenges that happen.
You make bread out of it?
And you make bread out of it? Well, you know what? We have someone else on the line here. It's Ava.
It's Ava.
Our KGNU Ava, who volunteers with us all the time. Welcome to KGNU. What's your comment,
Hi.
Ava?
Hi, Shelley. I've been listening since the beginning, and I thought it was going to be about losing weight, and it's talking a lot about wheat, and I have not cut out wheat, but I have, you know, my situation, my health has not been good, and I've been re-diagnosed with cancer, and I'm on a special diet now. I'm with an alternative, an alternative health care. I go to Reno to a special doctor. And since March, since April, I've completely changed my diet, and I've lost 30 pounds. As of this morning, I have lost 30 pounds, and I'm a little worried about it, but on the other hand, the number one thing is sugar, no sugar, and that is the one that is easy to metabolize. I also do not use bleached flour, no white flour. I stay off white flour. And I love vegetables anyway, so it's easy for me to do. I do a lot of juicing, at least I try to do one a day.
Well, and so, Ava, it sounds like you are doing a lot of great things.
But the
like
wheat,
reducing,
not. Yes. I'm not cutting off wheat, though.
I was wondering that. So you've reduced
sugar.
I
love wheat bread. My favorite bread, I hate to say this, is Costco's multigrain that they make in their bakeries. And it has wheat in it. I just read it again, and it's whole wheat and other things.
Well, how about it? What do you think, Dr. Davis? What ways could Ava decide whether or not this is a working food for her, given all the other positive changes she's made?
Well, just because I argue that removing wheat is so beneficial does not mean that making some other changes in your diet cannot also be beneficial. They can be. So cutting out soft drinks, for instance, is a big and positive move. Yeah.
So that's one.
And no carbohydrates either. No, I'm not allowed to eat potatoes right now, and no pastas.
So those are all good things. And as you know, the movement of using a very low carbohydrate diet for cancer prevention and treatment is gaining a lot of ground, gaining a lot of traction.
Well, yeah, we're trying to solve
I'll argue
the
with,
cancer. We're trying to solve
I'll tell
cancer.
You this: the bad effects of carbohydrates, whether it's sucrose in soft drinks or starches in, say, rice.
Right.
One of the worst carbohydrates is the amylopectin A of wheat. So it does help to limit carbohydrates and sugars, but you will not experience the full benefit as long as you have the amylopectin A of wheat acting as a starch or a very extravagant raiser of blood sugar. And as you see, people typically say that, I love my bread, and they often go as farther as that, I can't do without my bread.
Right.
That's because, I hate to say this, you're addicted to it. There's an opiate in it, and it drives your addictive behavior.
I believe it.
People, Ava, I'll tell you, I've had people rolled up in balls sobbing because they intuitively know that if they stop it within a few hours, a day or so, they're going to experience a very, very unpleasant withdrawal process that starts with anxiety and shaking and mind fog. So they know this. But we have to accept we have created a nation of opiate addicts, mm-hmm. including our children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ava, thank you for your comments, and you know, it sounds like Dr. Davis, your book gives a lot more details about just how to give this way of eating a try and the rationale. The cancer is very interesting to talk about because there are certainly studies demonstrating that cancer eats sugar. Cancer is a huge sugar eater, and that's one reason why diets that pull down foods that turn into sugar are so important to be looking at right now. And Ava, good luck on your journey, and good luck
I'll see you certainly. Tomorrow.
Yeah, that sounds good. Okay. Well, thank you for calling. So, Dr. Davis, there's a lot of these different topics that come up when people talk about food. Food matters to people so much. Can people really do this?
Many people have done it. Now, I have to qualify something, Shelley. This is probably economically unfeasible because we have allowed the world population to balloon to 7 billion people because they're consuming what I would regard as junk, mostly wheat, rice, and corn. And so as we undo this, it's going to present some problems.
Now Dr. Davis, I'm going to challenge you on that because right now about half of the world is overweight and obese, which means that they're eating excess calories because something isn't right in how their calorimetric meters work. So the world has people that are certainly starving, but it has about an equal amount who are eating too much because there's something in their bodies that's making them crave food more than it's necessary. So would it really be harmful to have people switch to a diet that means that their appetite is more balanced with what they need?
No, absolutely not. It would be wonderful. It would be the most spectacular transformation of global health you will ever see. Problem: what do we eat if we get rid of those 50% of all human calories? Now, that's a problem. So you're right. Better distribution, attention to growing better foods, whether it's livestock or other crops, those will help. But this can't happen overnight. This has got to happen, at least economically. It's got to happen slowly. I choose to do it right now. And I think most people who are listening would choose to do it right now because I'm not prepared to have rheumatoid arthritis and diabetes and obesity and mind fog just to please the world economy. But I believe you are absolutely right. If we could do this and if it were economically feasible, we would see a dramatic transformation in worldwide health.
Well, do you eat fewer calories now that you're not eating wheat than you did when you were eating wheat?
Yes, it's very typical. When you eliminate the appetite-stimulating effects of wheat, most people drop about 400 calories per day, can be as much as 800, even 1,500 calories per day. So while it appears that you're going to be spending more money because the foods minus cheap commoditized grains seem more expensive, what really happens is most people who run a budget for their groceries find that it costs no different or slightly less because of the fewer calories you're having to buy.
And so they're eating higher quality foods in many cases, but their appetite is more calm, so they don't eat as much.
Exactly. So a family of four, that would equate to about 1,600 fewer calories per day, which is almost the intake of another person.
Well, that's an interesting calculation, and we would love to do more calculations, but we're running toward the end of our show this morning. So can you tell us again, you have been kind enough to offer two of your books to people who call and pledge their support, and also a few tickets to the event that's happening in Denver. Can you tell us a little bit about each of those things?
Sure. So I'll be speaking on the 19th of August at 7:30 at the University of Denver Newman Center. And I'll talk about a lot of these concepts and go in more detail. I hope to have some video testimonies. So a lot of fun things are going to happen. I think people, when they hear the full argument, Shelley, this is not about gluten-free. It's not about being low-carb. It's about exposing what we've been told and showing you why this is true. And I think most will have their eyes open by this.
Well, thank you. We look forward to having you be in Denver in person to talk with people coming up there on August 19th. And I have to admit that I'm so intrigued by your lecture that my sister, who's having her birthday on August 19th, I called her up and said, hey, do you want to go to this lecture? And she said yes. And she said yes not only for herself but for her husband. She has a son who's diagnosed with celiac. She's been told that she's not a celiac person, but from what you say, there could be other issues. So anyway, we're looking forward to going and seeing you in person on August 19th. And thanks to all the callers who've called to pledge their to come in and ask their great questions. We really appreciate that, too. It's the end of our show. I'm Shelley Schlender, and thanks for being with us, Dr. Bill Davis.
Thank you, Shelley.